Thank you for tuning in to the September 7th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. In our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Edward Chang on the use of neuroprotheses for decoding speech in a paralyzed person with an arthria. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Eli Mutter discusses the trajectory and magnitude of change of the key clinical features and symptoms in patients with dementia with Lewy bodies and with Parkinson's disease dementia.
Hi, this is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. And for this week's podcast, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Eddie Chang, professor and chair in the Department of Neurological Surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. And we're going to be discussing a paper published recently in the July 15th edition of the New England Journal of Medicine titled Neuroprosthesis for Decoding Speech in a Paralyzed Person with Anarthria. This work was also featured in an accompanying New York Times article on July 14th, written by Pam Bullock. And I also want to mention that I had the opportunity to interview one of Eddie's co-authors, Joe Macon, for an earlier iteration of this work back in the August 3rd, 2020 episode of the podcast. So we'll encourage our audience to check that out as well. So first of all, Eddie, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to begin, if you would, Eddie, by just telling our listeners a little bit about the gentleman that you studied for this research, and particularly the nature of the stroke that led to his anarthria or the inability to speak, and then how you and your team set out to restore speech using this neuroprosthetic computer neuronal interface device.
Sure. So we created this new clinical trial called the Bravo trial. And the purpose of this trial was to restore communication for people who have lost that, either through a neurodegenerative disorder or a brainstem stroke. And the first participant in this trial was a man who basically had a stroke 15 years ago. That was a complication of a car accident. That he basically had a embolic stroke that was related to vertebral dissection and caused a stroke in the pons, the critical part of the brainstem that connects the brain to the spinal cord and cranial nerves. And that left him severely paralyzed in his arms and legs, and also in a way that was paralyzing the muscles of his vocal tract. His cognitive abilities are perfectly normal, but he really can't move or speak. And because he could still move his head and neck, he normally communicates by typing letters out on a custom keyboard using a stick attached to his baseball cap. And with that, he can basically type out about 5 words per minute. And so he's someone who's severely disabled from that remote stroke, again, over 15 years ago, and was the ideal candidate as the first participant in our Bravo trial.
You know, thank you for that. And I think that's helpful to best understand how and in whom this technology would be potentially most beneficial or translatable. So how did you and your team set out to restore speech? Can you just walk us through the process of the speech decoding using the neuroprosthesis?
Absolutely, sure. So, you know, with that in mind, there are a couple of challenges that we just didn't know. And these were scientific challenges. You know, for example, we didn't know if the speech commands of the brain would still work after 15 years of being dormant. And even if they could be revived, could we actually translate those brain activity signals to full words? And so for the past decade, we've been really intensely studying how the cerebral cortex brain activity related to speech allows us to control the movements of the vocal folds and the rest of the vocal tract. Those are the movements of the lips, jaw, tongue. And about 5 to 6 years ago, we basically figured out how cortical activity corresponds to all of the different movements of the vocal tract that give rise to every consonant and vowel in English language. So with that knowledge in hand, that was one of the main reasons and proof of principle that we had going into this study that we should really look at this in people who are paralyzed. And so in the Bravo trial, participants undergo a procedure. The first participant in this trial, who we call Bravo 1, underwent a surgical procedure to implant a device, basically a multi-electrode array of 128 electrodes, smaller than the size of a credit card, that was placed on the brain surface. It wasn't placed in the brain or penetrating into the brain. It was in the subdural space, right above the cerebral cortex on the brain surface. And that electrode array was connected to a port that allowed us to connect it to a computer. So the port is what we call percutaneous, meaning it allows it to go through the scalp and allowed it to connect to a computer. And through that device, we're basically able to connect to the part of the sensory motor cortex that controls the muscles of the vocal tract when you speak. So that's the basic schematic of what the device is. And then what we did with the signals to make it work did involve a bit of artificial intelligence and signal processing. As you can imagine, the brain signals for speaking are very complex and subtle. And there were a couple of steps in our algorithm in order to translate that brain activity into words. The first was to detect when someone was trying to speak. The next step was to translate those brain signals into words using a kind of artificial intelligence called machine learning. And this process didn't give us just the most likely decoded word, but also gave us the second, third, fourth, and so on word probability. So it gives us a probability of a given word that the participant was trying to speak. And the last step is what we call language model. And many of you may be familiar with what a language model does, but it's basically a statistical model of how words are ordered in sentences. And the language model step takes the decoded words and their probabilities and correct the words that might be wrong. And that's very similar to the autocorrect function when you text or use a word processor. And so we used everything we've learned about this particular brain area, applied it to this project. And we started with a vocabulary of 50 words, which can be combined to create several hundred useful sentences. And that's a summary of what we did in this project.
I love that because I think it brings to life the machine learning and processing aspects of what you're doing, almost sort of a Siri function for the brain and the predictive nature of the words, the syntax and the structure. So with that setup, Eddie, what kind of performance were you and your team able to achieve with this first patient, Bravo 1, with the speech decoding?
Well, on average, when we looked at individual words, just decoding the words, chance was about 2%. The probability that we could decode the target word was about 50%. And then with the language model, it got up to about 75%. And there were good days and bad days. Again, this is really just the starting point of this technology, really the first time it's been demonstrated. So I think there is a lot of room to improve. But on some of the good days, the computer algorithms could recognize up to 93% of the words accurately at about 18 words per minute. So we're very pleased with that kind of performance. The kind of things that we're working on right now is just trying to understand what accounted for the good days and bad days. How do we maintain higher accuracy and higher rates of word decoding? Another thing that we're working pretty hard on is to expand the vocabulary to hundreds of words as opposed to just the 50 that we started this project with.
Well, Eddie, I think it goes without saying that, you know, that performance alone, understanding the fledgling nature of this research, is certainly an improvement over the current state for this gentleman, Bravo 1, and no doubt will only get better and more refined over time. So it gives hope for patients and for us as providers taking care of these folks with devastating strokes affecting their speech and other neurological functions. So any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, thanks, Andy. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I think that this is a really exciting field. The work that we've done really builds upon 2 decades worth of intense research from neuroscientists around the world in this field called brain-computer interfaces. And speech is definitely just one facet of it, but it's a very exciting one because speech and language are so core to being human and the ability to communicate. And so, as you alluded to, you know, we're really just at the beginning of this process and excited about the next steps ahead.
Well, we will certainly look forward to future interviews as research moves forward and this growing body of work related to computer brain prosthetics and neuronal interfaces takes us further into the future. So Eddie, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations to you and your team, and of course our friend of the podcast, Dr. Macon, as well, and good luck with your ongoing work.
Thanks, Andy.
Hi, this is Jeff Ratliff with the Neurology Podcast. Welcome to this week's featured article interview. This week, I'm joined by Eli Matar from the University of Sydney. We're discussing his article in this week's neurology issue titled Progression of Clinical Features in Lewy Body Dementia Can Be Detected Over 6 Months. In this study, Eli and his colleagues followed a cohort of patients with Lewy body dementia over 6 months with periodic clinic-based assessments of their cognition, motoric Parkinsonism, and neuropsychiatric symptoms such as psychosis. Eli, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
So before getting into the details, I think it's important to note that this study included patients with dementia with Lewy bodies and patients with Parkinson's disease dementia under a collective category of Lewy body dementia. And I think for some listeners, they may view these as two separate, albeit overlapping diseases. So can you discuss the patients that fall into this category of Lewy body dementia that were evaluated in the study?
Sure. So as many listeners would know, dementia Lewy bodies and Parkinson's disease dementia are closely related diseases, both pathologically and clinically. Both require the presence of dementia, which is defined traditionally as cognitive decline severe enough to interfere with daily living. And both are accompanied by features such as motor Parkinsonism, cognitive fluctuations, and hallucinations. However, as you mentioned, they are considered separate diseases, and the most obvious difference between them is the temporal course of the symptoms. So in our study, dementia Lewy bodies was diagnosed according to the most recent consensus criteria, which was published in the Green Journal in 2017, and requires the presence of dementia in at least two of the core clinical features of cognitive fluctuations, hallucinations, motor Parkinsonism, and REM sleep behavior disorder. Parkinson's disease dementia, on the other hand, is defined as dementia occurring in the context of well-established Parkinson's disease. PDD shares the same clinical features as DLB, but in clinical practice is separated from DLB by a pragmatic, albeit controversial, one-year rule, which requires that prominent motor symptoms need to occur at least a year or more before the onset of dementia. And if the cognitive symptoms occur before or within a year of the motor symptoms, then it's classified as DLB. So in our study, we had 116 patients with Lewy body dementia. We ended up with 72 dementia with Lewy body patients and 44 patients with Parkinson's disease dementia.
Excellent. So highly overlapping diseases, as you've said. And I will admit, I was a little surprised that the questions you were seeking to answer this study weren't already well described. It seems straightforward enough, looking to measure what is the clinical progression of Lewy body dementia and using relatively common and straightforward bedside tests over that 6 month period to do so. So now coming into the study, what did we know and what did we not already know about the progression of these patients with Lewy body dementia?
Well, like you, Jeff, I was also surprised to learn that there weren't many studies looking into this question. And to provide some context, compared to Alzheimer's disease, there are relatively few symptomatic trials in Lewy body dementia and even fewer disease-modifying trials. And of the existing trials in Lewy body dementia, many have relied on cognitive endpoints, borrowing from the Alzheimer's disease literature. So reflecting this bias, many of the earlier natural history studies in Lewy body dementia focused mainly on cognitive decline, showing, for example, a worsening in the mini mental state examination score ranging between 1 and 4.5 points a year. However, we've just gone over the fact that Lewy body dementias are characterized by more than just their cognitive symptoms. And in fact, it's these other core features that patients and their caregivers often report. And it's these same symptoms that we think likely contributes to the poor prognosis and high caregiver burden associated with this disease. But there have been very few studies looking at the progression of these other features, and specifically at the progression of cognitive fluctuations and sleep disturbance in Lewy body dementia. Another point to make is that most of the existing studies that I mentioned relied on annual assessments and longer follow-up periods. But as you know, clinical trials typically run over about a six-month period, so we knew even less about the rate of progression of these features over those shorter timeframes. So one of the main motivations of this study was to address this critical knowledge gap and hopefully help us plan trials in Lewy body dementia.
And so with that context and with those details explained, I think it's time to really hear more about what you did and what did you learn in this study. So what measurements were you taking and what did they teach us about the progress of these patients?
Well, the main aim of this study, again, was to quantify the trajectory and magnitude of change of the key symptom domains of cognitive impairment, motor Parkinsonism, cognitive fluctuations, neuropsychiatric and sleep disturbance in a cohort of patients with Parkinson's disease dementia and dementia with Lewy bodies over 6 months. And so to do this, we analyzed data from a cluster randomized controlled trial conducted by collaborators from the University of Cambridge and Newcastle University in the United Kingdom. Patients were recruited from 23 memory and movement disorder services and underwent assessment using commonly used rating scales at baseline, 3 months, and 6 months. In this study, we included 116 Lewy body dementia patients made up of 72 DLB and 44 PDD patients, and we used linear mixed modeling to understand the trajectory of all key clinical features, including relevant confounders in the models. And within the timeframe of our study, we were able to show a statistically significant progression of cognitive decline using the mini mental state examination. We also saw significant worsening of motor symptoms with an increase in the motor subsection score of the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale, or UPDRS. And we found that cognitive fluctuation severity also increased over time using the Dementia Cognitive Fluctuation Scale. To measure sleep disturbance, we used the sleep subscore of the neuropsychiatric inventory. And while we weren't able to show progression over the whole cohort, in a post hoc analysis, we found that for those patients who reported sleep disturbance at baseline, these scores did significantly worsen over time. And in line with other studies, we didn't find any significant change in the neuropsychiatric symptoms using the neuropsychiatric inventory total score, the hallucination subscore, or a Lewy body dementia specific subscore. Another surprising finding, for me at least, was that the diagnosis of PDD or DLB didn't significantly affect the group level trajectory of any core symptom, which is comparable to the findings from larger observational studies in relation to rates of cognitive decline and survival between the two disorders. So I learned that by applying relatively common clinical instruments over a 6 month period, we can measure worsening of cognitive impairment, motor symptoms, cognitive fluctuations, and possibly even sleep disturbance in Lewy body dementia. And it also taught me that over short timeframes, and depending on the intervention, it may be reasonable to combine Parkinson's disease dementia and dementia Lewy body patients together to improve power in studies that use changes in core features as endpoints. And overall, these results are encouraging because it shows that Lewy body dementia can be a tractable disease model for performing clinical trials.
Yeah, I think it's really important and impressive knowing how many different domains of impairment that patients with these diseases have. It's valuable that we can sort of measure that progression and in a relatively short amount of time. 6 months is not a long period of time, especially when we look at it clinically and how often we may see these patients in the office. From a clinical perspective, do you think that the changes that you found in those different domains are clinically meaningful in that 6 month period of time that patients and their families and caregivers are going to notice an impact of decline in cognitive fluctuations, motoric Parkinsonism, et cetera, the other metrics that you mentioned?
I think that's a really important question, Jeff, and it's definitely an area where more work needs to be done. Previous work based on trials in Alzheimer's disease has estimated that a clinically meaningful difference in MMSE, or the mini mental state examination, is about 1.4 points, which is comparable to the 1.3 point decline in MMSE that we saw in our study. In the Parkinson's disease literature, the minimal clinically important difference in the motor section of the UPDRS is regarded to be about 5 points, which is slightly above our point estimate increase of 3.2 points over 6 months, but well within the annualized rate of change of 6.4 points. And it's also worth adding that the increase in UPDRS, which we found in Lewy body dementia, actually exceeds the annual rate of 2.4 points per year that's been reported in early untreated Parkinson's disease, which, as you know, is currently the focus of ongoing disease-modifying trials. But having said all that, so far, the minimal clinically important differences in fluctuation score or the sleep subscore of the neuropsychiatric inventory has not been established. And also whether the minimal clinically important differences in MMSE and UPDRS that we just discussed can be generalized to patients with Lewy body dementia is not known. I think more studies working with clinicians, patients, and their caregivers to gain an understanding of what represents a clinically meaningful difference in these measures is critical to guiding the choice of endpoints and ensuring that studies are adequately powered to detect these differences.
And given what you just said, and I'm sure I'm not alone, and we can agree that one of the questions that our patients ask us is about, what can I expect? What does the future hold? And so I wanted to sort of also ask you about how has the result and the lessons learned from this study influenced the conversations you're having with patients in clinic when it comes to counseling them or educating them on what to expect with regards to their prognoses and what they might be able to expect in the months or even years down the road?
I think it's important to mention at the outset that our findings reflect changes at the group level, but between individuals, we actually found a high degree of variability in several of the measures. So a lot of care must be taken when applying our findings to a particular individual. But in some ways, that in and of itself is an important message that I tell patients, which is that there's a lot of variations between patients with Lewy body dementia, and two patients can have very different trajectories and maybe shouldn't be influenced by each other's stories necessarily. Having said that, I think that this study reinforces that it is worth also seeing patients at least every 6 months or even more frequently and keeping a close eye for changes for symptoms such as fluctuations, motor symptoms, and sleep disturbances, which may change over that period of time, and treat them symptomatically where possible. Our findings also probably affirm the general experience we all have, which is while the symptoms progress, they do so gradually rather than abruptly. And I advise patients and their caregivers that any dramatic worsening of a symptom should prompt them to seek medical attention early, to look for other general medical issues such as urine or chest infection that can often be treated and reverse that change.
I think that last part's really good advice, that all of this is an insidious decline in a lot of situations, and precipitous decline should really sort of get someone's attention. Eli, I wanted to thank you for your time, and I think it's valuable to mention that your article really emphasizes that hopefully we can now use these scores as a metric to follow for disease-modifying trials down the road. And I think you'll probably share my experience that one of the other questions our patients with Parkinson's or Lewy body dementia ask of us is, what's in the pipeline from a research standpoint? How close are we, or what are we doing to try and cure this disease? And hopefully this study is a means and provides knowledge and tools that we can do that better down the road. So thanks again, Eli, and thanks for joining us today.
I definitely hope so, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Eli Matar on his paper in this week's issue of Neurology titled Progression of Clinical Features in Lewy Body Dementia Can Be Detected Over 6 Months. Please check out the article in this week's issue, and thanks for listening to the Neurology Podcast.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article that explores the experiences of community neurologists as they treated patients with neurodegenerative illnesses during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as a study examining the association between long-term dietary flavonoid use and subjective cognitive decline. You will find these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.